Some of the sort of contemporary outstanding issues. We know that, you know, we can argue, and I'm going to get to this a little bit shortly, that peer-to-peer file systems, BitTorrent, Kazaa, et cetera, whatever y'all are using these days, or whatever those people who are illegally sharing music, I'm sure you don't, are using to share software, this is proving to be an incredibly efficient way to distribute music. And indeed, Comcast started choking off BitTorrent about a year ago. They claim for quality of service reasons, because it does take a lot of bandwidth, but in fact, peer-to-peer systems are probably one of the best ways to deliver streaming video. Streaming video over the internet represents a very real threat to the business models of the cable companies. If you can get TV channels over the internet, who needs to pay $50 a month or more for Comcast if you can just get it over your connection? So they have a very, they recognize, in fact, that file sharing, BitTorrent in particular, is a very good way to distribute stuff. Obviously, from a business standpoint, BitTorrent and these other file sharing systems don't have payment systems associated with them, you might have noticed. And obviously that gives the RIAA, the record and movie companies, quite a problem. Another problem that I think we have to flag, particularly here in election season, is the fact that under the DMCA, that's the Digital Millennium Copyright Act of 1998, there's a provision that criminalizes reverse engineering software, reverse engineering cracks, reverse engineering copy protection. What does that mean? Well, it means that if you have a DVD, for example, and you want to break the copy protection, it is illegal to do so. Now, one can understand that, one can disagree with it, but one can understand that. Where it starts to get scary is when we look at things like electronic voting machines. How many of you have heard of Diebold voting systems, e-systems? Okay, y'all are familiar with those. As you probably know, the software in those voting machines is proprietary. That is, Diebold and the other companies that make these voting machines make intellectual property claims over the source code and over the code itself. They tell the public, look, you buy these machines, but we won't allow you to look at the software. So what does this mean? A lot of people, I'm sure many of you have heard the stories about the voting machines. You've seen the videos of voting machines that don't work right, etc. And there's a very real need to certify these machines. Well, as long as the machine makers say, look, the public and the experts can't have access to the code, please trust us, we then have an intellectual property barrier to having transparency in the way our voting operates. We can't really know as a public whether those voting machines in Ohio back in 2004 didn't willy-nilly reassign votes from Kerry to Bush, Shrub, Bush, whatever you want to call him. Remember, he's the guy in the White House? You might have, yeah, okay. So, you know, this is a very, very important sort of issue, because increasingly what we're seeing is that intellectual property rules and proprietary claims are being used increasingly to prevent public access to know how our democracy, ostensibly our democracy, works. I mentioned the other day patenting life, indeed, that one can patent not only processes, one can process gene sequences, etc. One of the famous horror stories there is that if one buys so-called Roundup Ready corn, that is corn that's been genetically modified so you can spray. If you know about how corn is grown, basically, the trick is you take a nice fertile field and you poison it to the point that absolutely nothing in the field will grow except corn. I mean, this is a really sick way of agriculture. And they use Roundup to kill all of the competing species. Well, if there's any leftover Roundup in the soil and you put normal corn in it, the corn can't grow either. So Monsanto, that makes Roundup, also makes Roundup Ready corn. So you can kill everything in the field, then put Roundup Ready corn, and it'll grow. Now, the problem with this is that it comes, if you buy Roundup Ready corn, it comes with a technology fee on it. And number two, you are not allowed. What have peasants done? What have all of our ancestors anywhere in the world, China, Africa, Europe, Asia, you name it, what have our ancestors done for centuries but save the seeds from last year's crop to grow for next year's crop, right? Standard practice. Humans have done it since the beginning of agriculture. Well, if you do that with Roundup Ready corn, you are stealing intellectual property from Monsanto. And indeed, Monsanto has sued a number of poor African-American farmers in the Mississippi Delta for replanting their corn seeds. So we begin to see that these intellectual property barriers become really quite onerous. We'll talk about licit models for legal models for content distribution, etc. Now, how does one enforce? Is this going to work? Yes, it is. Sorry. How is one going to enforce? Sorry. Go backwards. Oh, I got to be here to do it. What? Okay. So, how are the ways that outside of going to court, how are the ways that one enforces intellectual property rights? These are non-legal means. These are ways that companies can prevent people from illegally copying things. You're probably familiar with these. You get copy protection, again, like the CSS code on DVDs. You get encryption, oftentimes, where you have to get an encryption key or a key gen. If you're pirating software, you have to have a key gen that will generate a bogus key to make your software work. Most commonly, you have a need for a registration number. I have to confess, I buy 99% of all of the software I use regularly, I buy. And I, you know, once I buy it, in order to move it to a different machine to do the perfectly legal things that nobody has a problem with me doing, I have to keep track of all of those serial numbers. So if I want to move, you know, the software I use to make the podcast, if I want to move that to a different machine, I've got to have my serial number. Well, fact is, what I do rather than try and keep track of my own serial numbers is I have a database of serial numbers that floats around the net, and I use an illegal one. Why? Not because I'm breaking the law, because I have the software legally, but because it's just more convenient to use an illegal serial number than it is to use a legal one. I mean, this is where it starts getting crazy. Another barrier, of course, is the difficulty of reproduction, i.e., if you recall what I said the other day, going back to the days of manuscripts or the days of typesetting, the overhead of making a copy, the cost of making a copy was quite high. Now we make copies in seconds and we don't worry about it. Finally, with the question of different kinds of copy protection, different means of copy protection, every time there's a new copy protection system that's developed, you wait 2 months and a crack comes out for it. In other words, it's sort of an arms race, a tit-for-tat competition, and indeed it's basically, for the most part, virtually impossible to make crack-proof software. I have run into a few packages, and they tend to be very, very expensive, etc. Okay. There are legal means, of course, litigation. They can sue you for piracy, etc. But I think we have to keep something in mind about the American legal system. The American legal system is one which, on the surface, of course, is totally fair, right? You have a right to your day in court. We have all of the legitimate procedures, all of that stuff. Frankly, I think it's very, very good. The only problem is the cost of litigation is oftentimes very high. Again, very simple case. You want to invent a new video player. You're going to spend lots and lots of money doing legal research and doing patent research to figure out whether somebody's going to sue you. And even if you are in the right and you get sued, you're going to pay thousands and thousands of dollars just to get free of that lawsuit. And indeed, we see this happen quite a bit. The Justice Department back in the 1970s discovered a very clever strategy against the Black Panther Party and against the American Indian movement by basically arresting them on phony charges and then putting them in jail with very high bail and then saying, okay, we're going to break your organization by the cost of defending these people. American Indian movement by 1975 was basically pasted and basically impoverished by the federal government trying them. Similarly, this practice, which we call slap suits, slaps are strategic lawsuits against public participation. These were used against environmental groups starting in the 70s through the 80s and 90s, and now they're being used against people who are innovating or who are doing things in the IT space that large corporations don't like. If large corporations don't like what you're doing, they can make an intellectual property claim against you, and it will cost you thousands of dollars to get out from under it, even if your actions are entirely legal. So on the surface, you might be doing something legal, but these corporations have legal staffs that can very easily make your defense, frankly, too expensive even to contemplate. So let's look at where value comes in digital goods. If we're talking about copy protection, intellectual property rights and copy protection, where is the value located in digital goods? And this gets into some of the business stuff, so I'll go very quickly. I think we have largely three and a half parties. That is, we have the first party, of course, are the content producers. Again, as I mentioned on Tuesday, we sometimes roll together the original author or musician with the record company, with a publisher, etc. These are generally lumped together as the content producers. As I argued on Tuesday, we're starting to see a disarticulation of these two. That is, musicians and artists, etc., writers are beginning to see that their interests no longer align particularly well with the record companies, the publishers, the studios, etc. Now, there are alternative sources of legal content. These libraries have a stake in these battles. Libraries, as I mentioned again on Tuesday, pay quite a bit for access to content that can be shared, again, like ProQuest and some of the database services we have here. So that's the sort of half party. They're not a full participant in this. They're only a participant when their interests are engaged. The second major party are the intermediaries. These are the technology firms, the broadband companies, et cetera, all of those intermediaries that sit between the actual artist, musician, et cetera, and the consumer. Some of those are rolled in with a content producer group. And finally, there's the consumers. So we can roughly map this as three great parties: the content producers, the intermediaries, and the consumers. Where is value created? Okay, as I argued on Tuesday, something that economists don't like to talk about, lawyers don't like to talk about, is that attention is a very, very valuable commodity. Why do we have an advertising industry but to get your attention? They will spend millions of dollars to get you to move your hand 2 feet over to buy Colgate instead of Crest. Right? They are buying your eyeballs. They are buying your attention. Attention is a commodity. And if attention is a commodity, it has value. We know it has value because advertisers are willing to pay for it. So therefore, consumers do create value by their very act of attention. And we shouldn't forget that. What creates the market for many goods but collective attention? What is fashion but the consequence of collective attention on what's cool? People start buying certain items because other people are buying those items. They see other people doing it. So in other words, if I'm wearing a very chic Prada jacket, which I would never do, but if I'm wearing a very chic Prada jacket, somebody would say, hey, that's a really chic jacket. I want one of those. I am implicitly advertising for Prada, even though I don't ever wear clothes that have their labels on them parading the designer of the clothing. That, again, consumers create value. Very important point that lawyers and economists oftentimes don't try to address particularly well. So in the regime of intellectual property law, who wins and who loses? Under the old IP law, we have enforceability issues. I can skip this. Let me just go to the last one. One of the things that I think we see in intellectual property law in this last bullet point is we do have a fundamental conflict here within our culture, within our way of doing things with cultural products, intellectual products, etc. That is, we have a need to share. You know, as humans, anthropologists will tell us that as humans, one of the things we often do is we give things to other people. It's a gift. Gift giving can be studied in any society, whether it's a Native American society or an African society or a suburban Bloomfield Hill society. It doesn't matter. People give gifts as a way, as a ritualized way, indeed, of sealing social relationships. The more barriers that are put into that, the more difficult that basic form of human intercourse, human interaction becomes. And so what we run into then is, and this gets back to what you were reading on Moltz and Dane in the second week of this course, they talked a lot about public space. What is the foundation of a democracy but public space where people are free to share, free to express themselves, etc.? It's an open arena, not where anything goes, but it's an open arena where people can give, take, share, etc. It's that noisy, messy public space that we call civic space that's a foundation of democracy. And indeed, it's those spaces that I would argue are very deeply threatened by intellectual property law. Just as the town square, a public space, has been replaced by the shopping mall, a private space, we're seeing the public space of information sharing getting replaced by gatewayed access to digital goods. So in the end, it really is a balancing act. You know, you always hear this in public policy courses, and I find it really, really dull, but I don't want to be snarky about it. It is a balancing act. We all recognize in the end, okay, we have to have some intellectual property protection. But at the same time, we have to have that public space where we can share things. So the rights of consumers are very clear. We have fair use rights, as we saw in a previous slide on Tuesday. We have a right to personal use, a right to make backups, a right of first use, all of those sorts of things we discussed the other day. But the information producers also have rights. They have a right to amortize their investment, that is to recoup the investment that they made in their intellectual property product. They have, you know, some expectation even to make money off it, to make a living off this stuff. We could talk incentives that economists love endlessly. But we also have to talk about the problems of monopoly and monopsony. What is monopsony but a situation in which there are very few buyers for a specific product? This is indeed the situation in which authors and musicians find themselves. If you're a musician and you want to make it big on the charts, you have a very small number of channels, 3 to 4 major record companies, which dominate roughly 80 to 90% of the trade. And if they don't like you, you don't get there. They have a monopsony so that they can say, okay, you're not going to have access to the public except under the terms we dictate. So under standard contract law, as it's taught in law schools, contracts are always supposed to be between peers, between equals. But a contract between an author and a publisher, or between a musician and a music company, is not a level playing field negotiation. The monopsonistic publisher or record company holds most of the cards in that. So we have some emerging models that are trying to deliver intellectual property products that try to protect intellectual property. I just put in brackets here, and I invite you, if you're interested, to go out on the web and try and figure this out. How much money is actually lost to piracy? You know, if you listen to Microsoft, they'll tell you that every copy of software pirated in China is, you know, every Windows package that's pirated in China, something like 90% of all of the Windows installations in China are pirated. They will claim that every single one of those copies puts Microsoft out, what, $300? Something like that, whatever Windows costs, $100. What's Windows cost anyway? Not on student discount, market price. Anybody know? don't know, let's say Office, the package of Office and Vista together, I would guess is probably, what, about $400. So Microsoft says, well, $400, we're out $400 for every copy. Is that true? How many of us who have pirated Photoshop would otherwise pay $600 for it? Not very many. How many of us have used Photoshop? How many of us have used Photoshop for more than 20 hours? Yeah, maybe a third of those people. For the other two-thirds, are you willing to pay $600 for using Photoshop for a few hours? I don't think so. It's a very bad model. Yeah. Exactly, and one of the things we see with software companies is oftentimes they actually don't mind some piracy and some leakage. I remember 10 years ago, Microsoft used to have its hair on fire about Chinese software piracy of their products. Now they say very little about it. Why? Because they realize that with the entire IT environment of China using Windows, once they want to start working in world markets, they're going to buy legal copies. Microsoft will become is now the standard operating system in China. So as Chinese incomes rise and as Chinese businesses become more global, they'll go legit and they'll buy the software. It's a way of building a market, through piracy. They won't admit it up front, but they do it. Yeah, in the back. Yeah, Microsoft and Adobe are very different on this. Adobe tends to be very, very snarky about it. You know, their software calls home, for example. If you have an internet connection and you're trying to load up a copy of Photoshop or, you know, Creative Suite, it'll phone home and it'll look to see if your registration number is legit. And if it is, it'll block you from using it. Actually, I noticed that with Silverlight, the new generation video player in Windows does that too. So Adobe is pretty nasty about it. Microsoft has gotten looser and looser on the recognition that, you know, if there's some piracy out there, yeah, they're losing sales, but they're also establishing mind share. They're also getting attention. They're also making it the standard, and that's worth the lost money. Yeah, in the back. Oh, I'm not justifying piracy at all. What I'm saying is that for some businesses, a little bit of piracy is oftentimes viewed as okay on their side. I'm not saying it's okay at all. Under the law, again, it's entirely illegal. And one can, you know, what I'm saying is we have some serious real speed bumps in this whole sector. Another good example is we talk about some of these. I won't go through all of these. Yeah, I'll just go through a very quick one of all of these lists. Other ways you can support content distribution, you can do it through advertising. Google has shown us that advertising, advertising is attention. Attention is valuable. People are willing to pay for it. And Google provides a lot of services based on an advertising model. We know that quite well back from the old television days. Another piece of it, and what I really wish, you know, for those, the two-thirds of you who have only used Photoshop for a few hours, what I wish some of these software companies do would allow you to rent the software. I'd be perfectly happy to spend $10 to use Photoshop for a day. Just give me a day pass on Photoshop, I'll do what I want, and then I'm done. But what they do is that they give us this very lumpy sort of model. Either you pay the huge amount of money to have a license to it, or you don't have it at all, or you break the law. There's no sort of low-level compromise that you can come to with this. I'll skip trusted computing. So I drew up a proposal. You'll read about this later in the course. Looking at music distribution, how might we disintermediate music? And hopefully, my argument here, okay, let me just put this out front. I am assuming, and this is a very vulnerable assumption, I'll admit, I am assuming that at a low enough price, people will be willing to pay for their music. In other words, if you can get good, legitimate quality MP3s or FLAX or high quality audio files with all of the scans of the liner notes and all of that stuff, if you can get that for $3, shall we say, maybe $2, who knows, you will be more likely to go ahead and buy that product and be legal rather than going out and stealing it through BitTorrent. Okay? In other words, I'm assuming here that there is some price elasticity of demand, as the economists would call it. If you drop the price low enough, people will go legal. Okay, that is highly contestable. How many people would be willing to pay, instead of pirating a piece of music, if you could do it legally, get a high quality CD, get all of the liner notes, how many of you would be willing to pay, I don't know, say $3? Yeah, right, exactly. I'm not going to ask how many of you are pirating, because there might be cameras in the room. We have no way to measure the demand, but we'll move forward on that. Okay, let's look at what the cost composition is in the price of a $16 CD. I'm guessing, again, and this is from what I've been told, a relatively high guess. We pay 70 cents to the musician, $2 for transportation, that is to get it from the factory to the retail shelves, or get it to Amazon and then out from Amazon to you, $6 retail markup. That leaves a remainder of roughly $7.30 that goes to the record company. Okay, what's the record company doing for that $7.30? They are, number one, identifying talent. They're trying very, very hard to figure out what's hot and what's not. This is why, you know, in the 1990s, we got that endless string of boy bands. You know, they just kept coming and coming and coming because they knew that that stuff sold, and they kept selling it, right? If you tried to move outside that model, too risky. Keep in mind that this identifying talent is done very poorly in the record industry. Roughly 90% of what they produce loses money. The publishing industry is slightly better, the book publishing industry is slightly better, but most of what they produce, the vast majority of what they produce, loses money, which is to say they're very bad at it. One of the reasons they're very bad at it is that they don't have a good information loop. The only way they can know whether the public is going to like their music is if they produce a CD and put it out there on the market. Market the crap out of it, advertise the crap out of it, and hope it sells. And if it doesn't sell, then they go, oh, it didn't sell. In other words, they don't have any interim feedback from consumers as to what consumers really want. They have to go through the whole process of producing the entire product. What I'm arguing here, then, is that that process of identifying talent that the public will like is already characterized by a very bad information feedback loop, a very clunky one. We could make that better, I argue. Okay, the second thing they do, of course, is the studio work, the studio time, and producing the physical CD. How many people here prefer physical CDs to listen to music than digital files? Really? You like CDs better?
I mean, I like records, but a physical copy of something.
Okay, because it's real. Yeah, okay. Some of us have that. Walter Benjamin, the philosopher, said there's an aura around the real artifact. And, you know, some of us still are stuck with that. But for the most part, you can't stuff a CD into your iPod, right? You do it digitally. You send it all over the networks. And, you know, I play my music all over the world from a server. I won't tell you where it is. I have my music all on a server, and it's digital. I don't have to fart around with CDs. My point here is that the CDs themselves are perhaps an obsolete product. If we get rid of that physical product and go, like iTunes does, to purely digital distribution, then indeed, we don't have to worry about the cost and the environmental impact of those little plastic discs. By the way, in passing, I should mention that today the Copyright Royalty Board, which is a sub-office of the Library of Congress, is now sitting, as we speak, I believe, in a meeting setting negotiations on what Apple will pay the record companies for iTunes. The record companies want today a 66% increase in the amount of money that they're getting. Apple has said, we ain't negotiating. If you guys raise the royalties to that price, we will simply shut down. Interesting. That's just a little parenthesis. Finally, there's marketing. That is, obviously, the record companies then go out and tell you how sexy and cool these musicians are. You know, it's like tires and spark plugs. You buy this music and your sex life will improve. All of that crap that we get used to in advertising. Okay, so those are the three basic functions. And that marketing is a mindshare issue. That is, they're trying to get the public to say, oh, I noticed this music. It's good. I'll buy it. So, if consumers create value, as I alleged earlier, can we indeed substitute consumers for a lot of these processes? Can we have consumers expressing what they want? Can we have consumers expressing what's cool? This is what we do on the web. This is exactly what we do on the web. This is what the social web is all about, where we tell people about what we like and what we don't like, what's hot, what's not, etc. We can use the web to do that. We can post samples. Musicians can simply do a track or two, put them out on the web on a, you know, on a site. Let's just imagine one called jazz.music.biz. I'm a jazz fan, obviously, so I'd go to that site, see what people have posted, listen to it, recommend it, say this is really cool, or say, well, it could be a little snappier, or it sounds a little lethargic, or something like that. Musicians could get feedback, right? Again, the feedback loop now is very clunky. They could get immediate feedback this way. Then once people put it out there, musicians could then say, okay, the public has identified us as having talent. We will therefore go ahead and start releasing this stuff at a reasonable price. Hence, we can get rid of the first step, that is, of identifying talent. We don't have to do that anymore. The record companies don't have to do that because the consumers themselves do. Okay, of course, if we have a web-based distribution, an internet-based distribution system, we don't need the physical artifact. Let me back up for a second, though. Let's think about this. Think of studio work for producing music. Studio time, if you're a musician and you're going to go on, you know, a big-time label, you're going to fly out to L.A. or fly to one of the major cosmopolitan cities and go to a recording studio with all the glitz. Anybody ever been to the Motown place in Detroit? What's it called? Hitsville, USA, right? It's on Grand Ave, I think it is. Really cute because the entire studio is like, you know, it's like this big. And you go, wow, this is where Stevie Wonder started, the Four Tops, the Supremes, everything else. Well, today the record studio, the music studios are huge, very high tech, overbuilt, etc. The fact is, with one of these little Macs or a slightly fancier system, one can do that. We could very easily imagine regionally or urban-based music studios which would do the mixing, the production, post-production, all of the work one does. So we don't have to have the record companies. We can disarticulate that function and have that done on a contract basis by the musicians. So we don't have to worry about producing the physical artifact. Finally, once this stuff is distributed under this model, people are voting for it, people are saying this is cool, etc. If you're an African music fan, a hip-hop fan, you go to hiphop.music.biz, you see what's been posted, you like it, you download it, problem solved. And hence what we end up with then is a model that allows us to distribute music without the record companies at a price that the consumers are willing to pay, and where the musicians get paid a good bit more than they're getting paid now. Yes?
How would relatively unknown artists get access to the public without a big studio like the sites like Jazz that you just did, how, I mean, how does the unknown artist get noticed on the front page without being searched for specifically?
You post. I mean, this is a problem. And granted, the question was, how do you get noticed even on a site like this? Very good question, because we have the same problem in Google, right? When you do a search in Google, there's the ranking problem. If you're ranked, you know, if somebody does a search and you're ranked number 595, nobody's ever going to find you. So there's a time sensitivity to it. There's a load management problem. There's a ranking problem. Absolutely. But I'm arguing that this stuff is solvable. It can be put up there. What we don't want is what was the search company? Yahoo used to, I think, does Yahoo still charge to put you at the top of the rank? I know Amazon charges you to get, Google charges you to have those little ads on the right side. But Google rankings, you don't pay for the rankings. For a long time, I know Yahoo, you did. And we don't want that model. We don't want a model in which a musician has to pay to get noticed, because that puts us back in the same mess we were before. Yeah, it's an intention management problem on the web that I think is quite real. In the back, yes? I still can't hear you. Yes. Yep. Absolutely. And believe me, and this is frankly an attention management problem, right? How do you find the eyeballs in a way that's fair? Very big problem. You pay the website, the music.biz universe of websites, a commission. I mean, that's easily paid for. But how you actually do the attention management is a very sticky question. I think it's solvable. Perhaps by slicing your genres even thinner. So if you have a very thin genre, you know, I look at the ID3 tags on MP3s, and there's like 30 different kinds of rock music, industrial, you guys know it, I don't listen to this kind of music. And I go through there, and there's like 40 different kinds of rock music, and then I look in, what do we call African music? World. I think we need to disarticulate that or split that out a little bit, right? So in rock music, we do have genres that are usable. What do we do about crossing genres? That's a conceptual classification problem that we've addressed elsewhere. I'm not saying that this is the final solution, that this is the best fix. All I'm saying is if we start thinking either in this direction or a direction of ad-supported music and content, or in the direction of performance-supported music, we can then begin to disintermediate music distribution and frankly get rid of a lot of intellectual property problems and the downloading, the piracy, the lawsuits, and all of that. Recent news, not so recent anymore. The scariest intellectual property decision of the last couple decades, to me, was the Grokster decision. Grokster was sued by the movie industry. Grokster made Kazaa. Does anybody remember Kazaa? Many of you probably do. Okay. They were sued by Kazaa for the intent to facilitate infringement. That was the term that the courts used, that the plaintiff used, the MPAA. Now, this reminds me, I almost got jailed in about 1973, I think it was. You know, it was during the Wounded Knee takeover out in South Dakota, because the federal government was stopping Native Americans driving down Interstate 80 under a law that said that they were crossing state lines with the intent to incite a riot. Okay, we know rioting is illegal. Incite is a step away. Intent to incite, two steps away. Crossing state lines, three steps away from actually rioting, right? And I was there, and I was working with them, and so I was facilitating their intent to incite, to cross state lines, to riot. Well, this was a Grokster case. a version of this. So Grokster came up with this software to facilitate file sharing. They were ruled to be guilty of contributory infringement because they have a product that, in which it was demonstrated in court that they had the intent to facilitate infringement. They weren't infringing. They weren't really facilitating, but they did intend to. Gets a little scary. Because the consequence of the Grokster decision says that if you want to come up with a new kind of software that may be used for illegal purposes, that may be used for file sharing, let's look at BitTorrent. Perfect example. How many people are familiar with BitTorrent? Pretty much everybody. Okay. BitTorrent was developed by Bram Cohen for one reason: to facilitate the legal distribution of Linux software. The basic problem was when they'd come out with a new release of the Linux kernel, they'd put it on a server, thousands of people would hit the same server, the server would crash. So Bram Cohen said, okay, let's get a system where we can all share it as it's being downloaded. Much more efficient, takes a load off individual servers, very efficient way of doing it. Of course, within days, the pirates figured out, hey, we can share music with this sucker. This was not Bram Cohen's intent. But the next Bram Cohen who comes along, who wants to come up with a way to facilitate the movement of information across the internet, which is in essence all BitTorrent does, the next person who does that has to worry that there's going to be some lawyer who's going to knock on his door and say, we're taking you to court and you'll be $1 million out before this is all over. It is a serious barrier to innovation. Because the company doesn't even have to prove it. All they have to do is make a legitimate allegation to start costing you money in your defense. This is a way, basically, of stopping innovation. This, to me, is one of the gravest instances where intellectual property really does gravely stop innovation. Done with intellectual property. Little slide here says transition. And we are finally, with 25 minutes left, getting to this week's material. So, line across the page. I should have changed the style of the slide, but I sort of like this arts and crafts look. I designed my house with the same look, so it's, you know, my life. In any case, what is the digital divide? You know, we often hear this, and it's a fairly simple one. I'm sure if you go to the Obama campaign site, you'll see some reference to this, because the Obama people care about it. I doubt the McCain people do. Because if you don't have, why? No, I won't go there. I'm not supposed to say those things. So what is the digital divide? Generally, it's the haves and the have-nots, those who have access and those don't. Simple. But it's not. Because one thing you learned from the article you read this week by Mark Warshauer is you can throw computers at people, and they'll look at them and they'll go, oh, so what do I do now? What do I do with this? Because using information is not just a question of having a broadband connection and having a computer. It's a question much more deeply of making sense of it all, of having information literacy, which we talked a little bit about earlier in this class. But before we get into the finer points, let's just talk about the sort of standard recognized contours of this. Obviously, we know that the poorer people are economically, the less access to information they have. If you're somebody living in rural northern Ghana, you know, running your goats, chances are you don't have a computer or internet access. We can slice it thinner and begin to argue that the distinction between what we used to call the third world, i.e. the underdeveloped world, and the first world, folks like us, Europe, Japan, etc., that distinction between industrialized countries and underdeveloped countries no longer works. Because in this country over the past 30 years, we've seen the explosive growth of the third world within the U.S. Poor communities on reservations and inner cities, etc., who are almost as desperate as those, as people in Nigeria and Ghana, etc. The third world is within our own country. We have digital divides in those places. Not, frankly, on reservations I discovered this summer that have casinos, but reservations that don't, like the Navajo Reservation or some of the worst are the Shoshone Reservation on the north side of Grand Canyon, etc. No casinos, no money, no internet access, no nothing. These are third world communities. We also know that internet access and access to information is inversely correlated to the amount of melanin in one's skin. That is, race has a lot to do with it. We also know, or it used to be true, it's less and less true, it's true in computer training, but it's not true in computer use, that women have less access and less interest than men. Interestingly, what we're seeing, by the way, is two things. Number one, that women's participation on the user end of information services is every bit the equal of men. Women's participation on the production end of information services, particularly in the IT world, and in particular in computer science, is pretty dreadful. Interestingly, in almost all of the engineering professions, the percentage of women has been rising steadily since 1970. In computer science, the percentage of women has actually been falling over the last decade. There is a very real gender problem in computer science. I'm working very closely with the National Science Foundation, people like Jane Margolis, who are trying very hard to address gender problems within computer science and within the technical end of the information world. So we have the standards, the standard definition, race, class, and gender, on top of which I'll add sort of a Pierre Bourdieu European notion, and that is the notion of cultural capital. That is, one has to have a certain cultural framework, a certain cultural setting, to be able to look at a computer screen and say, hey, there's something useful here for me. Something beyond games. That takes a cultural environment in which one is predisposed to do those sorts of things. One of the things that really satisfied me this summer working at the Bay Mills Reservation up in northern Michigan was that I feel very confident that our project successfully convinced many of the older people in the Bay Mills community on the Bay Mills Reservation that there is not a contradiction between being Indian and using information technology. That in fact what they began to understand is that the two can be incredibly complementary. One of the long-standing problems of Native American culture has been its geographic separation from the rest of Native Americans in the U.S. and from the rest of the world generally. IT can connect them. And what I began to see this summer was a community in which the people over 50 began to recognize, hey, these kids are transforming our community. They're connecting our community with other Native communities across the U.S. and with the world. In other words, what we began to implant there this summer was a certain kind of cultural capital, a certain kind of cultural understanding of what computers can do for Native American communities. Now, one can argue that all of these problems will solve themselves in time. That is, computers become cheaper, designs become more standardized, people get used to computers, and it just kind of solves itself, kind of the way mobile phones seem to have. Though with mobile phones, I admit, there's a generation problem on mobile phones. I have a digital divide on mobile phones. I have one of these. Do I have it here? Yeah, I have one of these guys. Nope, I don't have it. Yeah. I have one of these mobile phones, and I look at it, and I don't understand this sucker. I want to use it. I hand it to one of my students. I go, okay, fine, right? Digital divide there by age. So the argument is, okay, people learn, people grow up on this stuff. You guys never found computers particularly mystifying. Believe me, my generation did. It's a question of cultural implantation, and maybe these problems will solve themselves. I'm not so sure. Indeed, there are still very real cognitive design and cultural issues. So it's not just, I would argue, an adoption lag. So there are two universes of the digital divide. Again, this gives us the distinction between the developed world and the third world. Again, the third world is just as much within the U.S. This is where the U.S. and Europe are quite different, or at least Western Europe. Western Europe, with a few exceptions like the banlieusards in Paris, the poor ethnics on the rings of cities, they have a little bit of it, but most of Europe, for the most part, doesn't have these pockets of desperate people left behind, desperate people simply ignored, not taken seriously as full citizens of the society. So we have these third world communities within the U.S. Very real cost issues, but the character of these two, of the divide in these two areas is different. In the developed world, we still have a, even within middle class communities in the U.S., we still have a digital divide. Some of it has to do with age, some of it has to do with cognitive and cultural positioning, things like that. Some of it has to do with lousy pricing models. I have to say, yet again, that the U.S. is number 22 globally in popular access to broadband. We're behind virtually every other industrialized country, just in the basic access to high-speed information. That's largely a cost issue because we've allowed Comcast and a small number of providers to monopoly price these things. We decided in the Telecom Act of 1996 not to regulate cable prices. So they're free to charge whatever they want. It's not considered infrastructure, it's considered a luxury service, despite the fact that it's rapidly replacing most of our previous modes of communication. Now, we're often told, again, the technical fix. I meant to bring in my one laptop per child computer. Anybody seen these things, little cute little guys, green and white? They're really cool. I can't run them. I think they're, you know, I'm used to seeing a regular operating system, Windows, Linux or Mac. You open up an OLPC and it's like you got all these pictures and it's mysterious as to what they are, but it's a computer that's made for kids, you know, you can dump soda pop on it and it doesn't hurt it. It's really cute, but it's really misconceived. It's a very noble effort. I like the idea, but the fact is you cannot drop technology on a community and expect it to fix the digital divide. Again, to get back to the it will solve itself problem, we can look here at the adoption curves. Over time, these are the years down here with various new technologies. Interesting thing here, by the way, and I think we might see this with broadband in this upcoming economic recession, what happened here? Look at the dates. The Depression. People would drop phone service because they paid monthly for it. With radio, once you buy the radio, you don't pay anymore, right? Because this is a subscription service, you get that. We're going to see this. The numbers aren't very good more recently. But I think we're going to see dips in cable TV and in broadband subscriptions in the next couple years as people discover, well, I really can't afford $50 a month for a broadband connection now that my job's been outsourced to China, etc. But the implicit argument, when you see a graphic like this, the implicit argument is that at a certain point, everybody pretty much gets onto it. Everybody has radio. Everybody has TVs. I remember when I was a kid in the late 60s, there was all of the news stories saying, well, now everybody has TV. TV is the American norm. Even the poorest people in America have TVs, and for the most part they did. So you see incredibly high penetration rates. What we're seeing in the U.S., and this graph doesn't show it, so I'll have to use some of this dreadful crap called chalk, What we're seeing in the U.S. on broadband adoption is this. It's starting to flatten out here at about the 65 to 70% level. In other words, the rate of growth in broadband adoption is now flattening out. So instead of the ubiquity we used to have of wired phones, now y'all, how many of you have wired phones, by the way? You know, regular old fashioned? Really? So none of you have like wired phones wired to a, wow, what a transformation, okay? But how many of you have phone service? Everybody does. Okay, interesting. There's an interesting, very interesting adoption curve of this sort. So we can say with your group in mobile telephony, we're up at about the 95% adoption level. Almost all of you have it. What we have with broadband, though, is that it's starting to flatten out at about 70%. So if we're going to talk about digital democracy, if we're going to talk about the future of a society in which everybody is wired, we're leaving out 30%. This problem is not solving itself through regular market forces. Why? That remains to be seen. Just in the background, I'll give you this stuff later, but I'll just put it out here. We know new technologies cost less, so we can say, okay, the cell phone you have now is 30 times more powerful than the old cellular one phones of the 80s, and it costs roughly a quarter the price. In other words, a price drops that facilitates adoption. This is really confusing. I beg you to take a look at it offline, or rather outside of class. It's a very interesting historical analysis that I developed. I actually wanted to publish this at one point, but decided the better of it. But it shows you adoption curves, cost curves, and how people adopt new technologies. It's the economic framework and financial framework for new technology adoption. We can look at this kind of information, and say, okay, the market will work, just like the market has worked so well on Wall Street the last 6 months. Markets are sovereign. They do everything right. Of course, that is not true. We're beginning to see the flattening of the adoption rates. We saw this starting to flatten in the early 2000s, and the rate of increase is very, very low at this point. Again, we're leaving, it seems, roughly 30% of the American population out. An interesting piece of this, though, that I think we do have to attend to for a moment and give it some thought, is that in the period roughly from 1998 to 2001, there was a very, very interesting kind of hiccup. Before 1998, you'd put a computer in front of an old person, in front of, you know, somebody over 65, and they'd say, oh, no, those computers, they're just too crazy. They're just too complicated. I can't do those. You know, it's too far away from me. Nobody knows how it happened, but almost virally, in the period between 1998 and 2001, elderly people started using the internet like crazy. And the digital divide that had been very discernible when one looked at age differential largely disappeared. Why is that? Online shopping, good one. Online medical consultation. You could go to, what was the one, what's the big medical one, doctor? I can't remember. Say what?
WebMD.
WebMD, right. Old people, just, you know, they saw the ads for WebMD on the TV, and they get a computer, and there was WebMD. It would tell them everything they needed to know about osteoporosis, about, I don't know, diseases of old people, you name it. So they like the medical stuff. What else? And it gives them mobility, right? If you're over 65, you're not, oftentimes not really inclined to drive all that much. So online shopping's pretty cool. What else does it offer? What do old people really like to do? looking at pictures of grandkids. How many of you have been on the web and talked with your grandparents, exchanged pictures? Dear grandma, here's a picture. How many of you have done this? Come on. Yeah. I mean, grandparents, I mean, it went like wildfire through the old folks community. They said, hey, I can see my grandkids' pictures. And probably, you know, your parents were posting the pictures to your grandparents while you kids were little kids. Yeah. Say what? Yeah, hook up with each other. I don't know what they do, but you know, they can build social relationships. Because again, as you get older, mobility is much more difficult. Social networking, it's interesting, you know, there've been studies of this, and the narratives, you don't get it quantitatively, you get it qualitatively, the stories old people tell. And they'll say time and time again, for years I looked at computers and the internet as this alien high-tech sort of thing. It was about as inviting as going into a nuclear power plant. But now, as I go to it, I can talk with my friends, I can meet up with old friends that I hadn't seen in years. A very interesting thing we've seen just in the past 4 to 5 years is large companies are now starting to put together web portals for their retirees. They're beginning to understand that their retirees are a very, very rich source of organizational memory for these companies. So a lot of companies are starting to bring their retired people back into the company through the internet. And that sort of loneliness and abandonment that a lot of retired people get, like, what do I do with my life after 40 years working at these companies, and now I'm just out there and abandoned, now they can hook up again. This has happened a lot just in the last 5 years, and it's been very good for the elderly folks, and it's been very, very good for the companies that are smart enough to figure out that there's that knowledge asset out there. So we can talk about, we do have very real price issues. Among industrialized countries, we have the worst service and the highest prices, speaking in a large sense. There was an interesting process that Disney faced. Disney was building out in Korea. Korea is by far the world's most advanced broadband company. You know, Jason, you were telling me the other day, you go on a metro, go on a subway in Korea, and you'll see people pulling out their cell phones and watching TV on them, right? I mean, this is a country that is really, really fully wired, is not what it is. I mean, they're fully wireless connected, high speed broadband stuff on handheld devices. It's ubiquitous, right? Japan, similarly. These are models that we're not seeing in this country. The U.S. is getting increasingly backward in terms of wireless telecommunications, wireless computing, etc. Why? Because we have two sets of companies that look at these markets as being incredibly lucrative, and they keep their prices so high and their quality so low that our innovation in those spaces is really dreadful. And what we're beginning to see, we see it with the iPhone, for example, is that truly leading edge communication and computing devices are becoming luxury goods. Yes, the price of the iPhone has fallen, but the price of the service has not. The quality of the service is pretty sketchy. My point here is we are reaching an era in which a whole set of services, which in places like France, like Korea, like Japan, are taken as granted that pretty much every citizen has access to those are becoming luxury goods. So how do we solve this problem? First and foremost, we have a tradition in this country, as have most other industrialized countries, a recognition that there's certain stuff that you call infrastructure. A foundation, a technological foundation on which any society rests. And if you're going to have full citizenship, everybody has to have access to this. These include telephones. virtually impossible. It was virtually impossible after about 1920 to hold a job if you didn't have a telephone and if you didn't have a bank account. Those became infrastructure. Bank accounts we didn't do in this country, but most other countries, for popular banking, because banks didn't want to bother with small accounts, for popular banking, postal services used to do it. Do you remember that with the PTT? They used to have PTT checks. They had this pretty much in almost every other country of the world. The U.S. didn't decide that banking, popular banking, was infrastructure because there were enough small banks by the way we wrote banking laws. But telephones, yeah. Believe me, in getting, how do you get telephones to poor people and to rural people? The cost of service to somebody out on a farm in South Dakota is prohibitively high. Believe me, I have a neighbor up the hill from me who can't get Comcast because Comcast wants $1,300 to stretch a cable 300 feet. So he's completely off cable. They don't want to support this. They don't want to do the build out because it's expensive. If you're going to have full citizenship, you have to build the infrastructure. We did it with phones. We did it with electricity. With the phones, we had rural electrical cooperatives. We had price regulation to keep the phone company, because there was one. For the most part, there were small rural phone companies, but for the most part, it was Ma Bell, AT&T. Highly regulated, because in fact, what the government understood is that there are certain things we call natural monopolies. It makes no sense to run two sewer systems in a city. This is, poop sewage. What do you call it? I don't know. You know, you have wastewater sewage and you have really nasty sewage. There's no need to run two parallel sewage systems, right? It's incredibly expensive. So you say, okay, we have to have one. It's most cost effective. But if you've got an owner of a sewage system, which we don't, thankfully, yet, because we haven't privatized that yet. Believe me, we'll deregulate that the way we did airlines, the way we did everything else. I won't say if somebody wins. So there's economic sense to have monopolies in certain service provisions. We don't want dual phone systems. We don't want dual electrical systems. So we want one provider, but if we have one provider, we have a monopoly. So we have to regulate them. Tradition that goes all the way back to the 1880s. Automobiles, no, Americans don't have a right to an automobile. I know it's hard to imagine, but we actually don't. That's not in the Bill of Rights. Somebody should tell John Dingell this. Guy is so addicted to automobiles, it's crazy. But in fact, as part of public policy, the U.S. government and state governments and even school boards have recognized that cars are part of the infrastructure for American society. And in fact, the government used to figure that railroads were the infrastructure for an industrial society. They gave a good bit of land to the railroads, you know, stole land from the Indians, gave the land to the railroads, and then built out the entire Trans-Mississippi U.S. based on railroads. Then in the 1930s, 20s and 30s, they decided, rail, not too good. We'll replace rail with cars, basically quit subsidizing rail, started subsidizing highways, building all these highways everywhere. And now we have these communities where you can't live without a car. Not very good for the future, but that was the infrastructure planning framework of the mid-20th century. Driver's Ed, how many of you took, do they still teach driver's ed? Yeah, exactly. And you know, one can say, okay, we want safe drivers. In France, they don't teach driver's ed in schools, do they? You pay for it, right. And this is a difference. In most other places, the U.S. is the only country I know where we actually have driver's ed taught in public school. Yeah. Say what? Oh, good. No, frankly, because driving is not a right. One can argue, okay, that for public safety, assuming that 90% of the population is driving, it might be smart to teach people how to drive in schools. Frankly, you know, these are decisions that we make. What are we going to subsidize and what are we not? The justice of this, I'm not addressing. What I am saying is that governments have understood that the automobile is part of the infrastructure. So we've got electricity, we've got sewage, we've got phone lines, electrical lines, all of this stuff, which as a culture, as a political society, we've understood as infrastructure. Now what we're seeing is that the internet is displacing telephone, post, right? One of the earliest pieces of infrastructure we had was the postal service, right? Written in the Constitution. We understood that collectively as infrastructure. At this point, we do not treat broadband access, we do not treat the internet as public infrastructure. As long as we work from that assumption, it will inevitably be expensive and not very good. I know there's a whole argument about tragedy of the commons and all of that, but I won't go there. It's way too academic. It's a theoretical argument. This goes back most recently. I didn't mention I wasn't even aware of it, the so-called Brand X case of 2005, which sealed this Brand X case in the Supreme Court. But telecommunications law in the U.S., going back to the 50s, sealed with the Telecom Act of 1996, basically said, okay, there's two different kinds of stuff that moves over wires. Do we see a mistake here already? The internet doesn't care what moves across wires. It can be TV, it can be phone service, it can be anything. But the feds, in their brilliant technological mastery, said, oh, there's two different kinds of stuff. There's communications and data. Communications are infrastructure, and data is a luxury good, so we won't regulate it. It is a distinction that barely made sense in 1996 and makes no sense today. So we run into this weird system. I'm not about to pity AT&T, which is the local phone monopoly here. But AT&T, under the 96 Communications Act, has to allow DSL providers to use its wires. They have a must-carry rule. That's why you can get DSL. You have to pay AT&T to have the line, I believe, right? Pretty sure you'd pay them to get the line, but you don't have to buy your DSL service from AT&T. Weirdly enough, the cable companies don't face the same rule. Comcast doesn't have a must-carry rule. Comcast wires are Comcast wires, and nobody else can touch them. One of the things I think we really have to think about in the regulatory sphere to have a fully digitally empowered culture is to regard the internet and broadband as a fundamental foundation of 21st century democracy. This means that we regulate it, that we treat it like a monopoly, a natural monopoly, exactly the same way we do electricity, exactly the same way we used to do railroads, etc. Those regulatory systems worked very well in the past. You saw how phones under a regulatory framework reached about 99% adoption, automobiles, etc., thanks to these subsidies, thanks to an implicit recognition that you have to have these certain preconditions. So what we face then is a digital divide that's structured into our very legal framework. And behind that, a digital divide that's structured in the way that politicians think about our own information environment. That has got to change. I invite you in this electoral season, I might as well close on this because it's a good folding point. I invite you in this electoral season to go to the websites of Obama and McCain and read their telecommunications policy. Read, for example, what the two candidates say about net neutrality. Let me explain net neutrality because, in closing, it's very, very important. Net neutrality follows the old principle of the regulated infrastructure. That is, that the service provider cannot discriminate what goes over the system. Just as Bell Telephone could not forbid certain words, certain conversations, certain communications over the phone line, we need a system in which the broadband providers cannot say, oh, well, you can do this service over this line, but you can't do that service. Let me give you a very good example of this. Comcast offers voice over internet, right? It's an internet protocol. It's kind of like chat, but you have physical phone devices. I have VoIP at home. I love it. Good service. Not a good service provider. They're cranky. They're not. Their customer service sucks, but, you know, I can fix these things myself, okay? So no problem. Nonetheless, I pay roughly $20 a month for this service. Well, Comcast is selling exactly the same service. Damn good service, by the way. Free long distance, you know, the whole works. Non-metered service. Really cool stuff. Comcast offers a not-as-good service for $40. I pay half of what they're offering. Now, Comcast, there is no rule that says Comcast can't simply say, we're not going to handle anybody else's VoIP packets. If you want to use VoIP, you use ours. That's what we call discrimination. When they say you can't use BitTorrent on Comcast because it threatens our model of cable television distribution, they are discriminating. The basic fundamental of digital democracy is device neutrality and net neutrality, allowing citizens to run whatever packets, whatever content, using whatever standards compliant devices they want. We don't want to go back to the days in which, like the phone companies, Verizon will tell you what services you're allowed to use on their phones. We don't want that on the internet. The cell phone model is incredibly expensive, incredibly exploitative, very hindersome to innovation, whereas the internet is open and it has to stay open as part of the infrastructure of a democratic society. Thanks very much.